probably most people would argue that the United States became a major power on the world stage by virtue of its military strength. However, this morning, in this part of Focus, we will explore a different kind of dominance as we talk with historian Victoria de Grazia. In her recently published book, Irresistible Empire, she argues that Europe and the European way of life was changed, some might indeed, depending on your viewpoint, say defeated, not by guns, not by force, but by America's consumer-oriented capitalism. It is something that perhaps has accelerated in pace in the last 10, 15 years, but something that has been going on for much longer than that, certainly back before World War II. And it is also something that she argues that Europe participated in quite voluntarily. The book, Irresistible Empire, subtitled America's Advance Through 20th Century Europe, is published by the Belknap Press of the Harvard University Press. And our guest, Victoria de Grazia, is professor of history at Columbia University. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We'd like to bring you into the conversation. Your ideas, your thoughts are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, the number to use is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, or if you might happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States somewhere, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. Professor de Grazia, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think that perhaps the place to start is, in a sense, where I began my introduction, and that is that it is undeniable that the United States has power and has military power, and part of its influence is by extension military power, but this is a different kind of power, and in fact, it's something that I think other scholars also have been commenting on, writing about, talking about more and more, I think, and that is acknowledging the extent to which other kinds of power, whether it's economic power, whether it's the influence of American culture, particularly American consumer culture, the way that kind of power has contributed to and been a foundation for American dominance on the world stage.
Yes. You know, I think it was from the outset that American leaders, and particularly the more idealist ones, someone thinks of a Woodrow Wilson, thought that America's power was not going to be military. It was going to be through the spread of its ideals, but in a very material way, through goods. In the sense of goods that are commodities, but goods which bring good, bring people's life standards up, make them look more alike so that they will get along better, goods that will defeat the imperial powers in the old sense, the gunboat diplomacy. And I think over the course of the century, that dimension of American power was often used, and then in the late Cold War, and especially in the 1980s, it began to be lost sight of. And then after the fall of the Soviet Union, there it is. Maybe we can use it to reshape the world in a different way, since we no longer have a big militarized superpower against it. That's not how it turned out. Mm-hmm. But I think that's why we're all interested in what this soft power, as it's been called, is. You know, how powerful is it? What can it change? You know, can it persuade people to get along in the world and to love the United States?
I think it is interesting just how far back this goes, particularly because we tend to think of the pace of globalization picking up, particularly within the last decade or two. And you mentioned the name Woodrow Wilson. And it is interesting to note that, and you begin, in fact, noting in your introduction that going back as far as Woodrow Wilson and a speech that he gave in July, in fact, of 1916, he was talking to a big gathering in Detroit where he essentially said, go out and sell. And that would be indeed a way of spreading not only American commercial products and influence, but also American values. He saw that as an avenue to do that, as far back as 1916, certainly before World War II.
Yes, and he was saying it at the very moment that the Europeans were engaged in the first biggest battle of the war, the Battle of the Somme, which killed hundreds of thousands of soldiers. So the contrast that he was also aware of an America that was conquering by its bombardment of goods or its shipping out of goods, and the Europeans, whom he was arguing, were seeing global diplomacy and relations through force. So that contrast that he was making was very important to the American project, that America would work through a diplomacy of goods and not through an old style of imperialism. So, it is a long story. It's a story that starts with the great growth of American industry, with the fact that the U.S. did have significantly different resources from other areas of the world, from having a big immigrant population that was so needy, and gradually building up then a very dynamic consumer culture.
Mm-hmm. It obviously it is difficult to, or perhaps I would say it is easy to overgeneralize and to use sweeping terms like American culture and European culture, terms that begin to be so broad that you almost have to ask whether they mean really, whether they mean anything.
Oh, I
agree.
Or
you have to be more careful about how you use them. Now, having said that, though, if we do say something like, well, particularly before World War II, if there was something that we would put in quotes and say was European culture, and we contrast that with American culture, both of those things in quotes, what would European culture constitute, and in what ways do we contrast that with what we think of as American culture?
It's just a nice way to frame the problem, to say, what is this European culture against which the Americans are fighting, and the Europeans themselves would have said, "Well, we're deeply divided." There were the conservative forces that said European consumer culture is about craft and about the right style for the right people. So it's right that the bourgeois live in a certain way, and it's right too that the workers live in their own poor, modest way. And the twain shall never meet. And then the left said, these are terrible class divisions, and we should have a revolution, or at least very significant reforms, that allow the workers not to have a lot, but at least have the necessaries, and to get rid of the parasitical luxury elites. And then a third way emerges, which is the most dangerous, which was the Nazi fascists, which come along and say, all right, we're going to reorder Europe, make it as have a big market as the United States, my conquest, and we're going to develop new goods that are like the American ones. Instead of the Ford, we'll have the Volkswagen. Instead of the RCA Victrolan radio, we're going to have the popular radio. And that way we'll show our Aryan citizens that they are as good as the Americans, that there is a kind of populist, reactionary democracy that we are supporting against this new world American style of mass democracy. So, what the U.S. is up against in Europe and what the Europeans are doing is complicated. But I think that we need to understand that there are these various positions, which in Europe, conservative position, a socialist position, which then gets tied to the Soviet Union, and then this very reactionary fascist position. And those are all defeated, if you you want as part of this American advance.
Let me just very quickly again introduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Victoria De Grazia. She is professor of history at Columbia University. And the ideas we're discussing here this morning, you will find in her most recent book, which is titled Irresistible Empire, America's Advance Through 20th Century Europe. It is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And I'm sure that if you would like to read the book, you can go out and find it in the bookstore. And, of course, questions on the program are welcome, as always. You want to call in, make a comment, offer some thoughts of your own, ask a question, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talk about a number of really interesting things. In a sense, each chapter is devoted to a different kind of a theme that has to do with American marketing and American ways of thinking and so forth. And we can talk about some of those things. But one of the really basic issues I'm interested in is having you talk about the idea of standard of living and what that constitutes, what are the material hallmarks of a good standard of living, and how it is that through American agency, Europeans started thinking differently about what that meant, about what a quote-unquote decent standard of living was, who defined it, how to get it, and how, indeed, the American commercial culture started to change the way that Europeans thought about how they were living and perhaps what they aspired to.
If one thinks of a traditional society, you know, you have the bourgeois man in his top hat, the peasant in his cap, and it's accepted that they have different styles of living. You know, and nothing can bridge that. Each person knows his or her status. And what was so striking in the United States is really very early in the 19th century that goods begin to be used by people to show that they have something in common. And so, industries begin to produce new kinds of innovative goods, which don't have any particular class connotation. Okay? The blue jeans, which starts out as a work outfit, and then gradually over time will spread to become the jeans, and doesn't have any clear class connotation. And that kind of good is especially attractive in a country like the United States because of the great variety of ethnic groups. It gets pushed as though that people will feel more part of the collectivity. And out of that comes a value which says, all right, we Americans, we have standards of living which say that we need the basics. Okay? And the American working class was particularly emphatic on that, the male white American working class, because they said, look, we need a decent salary to get the necessaries of life in order to distinguish ourselves from those Chinese coolies who will work for nothing, or those poor black farmers, and they didn't use that term, obviously, who will sell their labor for nothing, or women who will just get cheap low wages. So this American standard was very much based on the idea that there would be a decent wage, and that wage then would be spent for what they call decencies, that is, a house, decent quality food, decent quality clothing, and that was open to everybody. Everybody could get a decent wage, and with a decent wage, they could get these new consumer goods. So it says, high wage will lead to a decent standard of living, and this should be universal to everybody. Now, it's true that it wasn't, and it would take a long time, even in the United States, to get a decent wage for workers. But it set a kind of universal model to say, look, decent wage, necessaries of life, people acting, looking alike, and that should be for everybody in the world. Mm-hmm. And when they said that, they particularly were saying, in Europe, it's not like that. There are bad wages, and classes are fighting with each other, and people aren't the same. So it's a very remarkable argument that says if you share the common consumer goods, you're going to end up being more alike, and that's like a democracy based on consumer goods through the marketplace. So it's a very original idea. It's in some ways a very revolutionary idea, and it stands behind this kind of pushing out of American goods through the century.
Mm-hmm. Of course, to cultivate in people the desire for that kind of standard of living, you have to show them what it looks like. And one of the things that I think you also argue that America was particularly good at was doing just that, particularly taking advantage of mass communications.
And it's just remarkable.
The big one and the thing that you talk about is American movies. They were used to sell in a lot of ways to show Europeans, say, see here, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is what you're supposed to be going for.
Oh, right. They're, these remarkable, scenes of, let's take just the worker, of how workers look, and then in advertising, I mean, beautiful, high-quality photographs, which were then reproduced in European magazines about, how working-class families looked when, in Europe, in a magazine, you would...
Professor DeGrazia, I think we lost the guest. And I tell you what we'll do. We'll just have to try to get her right back on the phone, and we will resume our conversation. And I'm sure that we'll take just a moment. Sometimes these things happen. Let me again introduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Victoria DeGrazia. She is an historian. She is on the faculty at Columbia University and has been writing about Europe and the relationship between Europe and the United States for a long time. And in fact, this book that we're talking about here this morning was quite a long time in the making. The title of the book is Irresistible Empire. The subtitle is America's Advance Through 20th Century Europe. It is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press and, again, looks at what the kind of things that different kinds of scholars have referred to as American soft power. That is not so much military force, but the force of American consumer culture on the world, particularly on Europe. And I'm told we have you back.
Yes, indeed.
My apologies.
The glitches of late capitalist technology.
Well, yes, it's not perfect. It's a swell technology, but it's not perfect. Anyway, we're talking about mass media, the way that Americans used mass media, particularly to promote a certain kind of lifestyle, a way of living, and to show to Europeans, and as I said, sort of to show this is what it's really like, this is the good life, and this is what you can have if you just come along with us.
Right. From a Europe in these small European theaters to see up on the big screen these illuminated images, these seemingly live images of common people, or to see them in magazines, or to see them, goodness knows, in all the photographs, like the Kodak photographs that were sent home by immigrants to their families. And it was a remarkable vision, because if they'd been living in a province or a small town of Europe, they wouldn't have seen those images of their own workers. Mm-hmm. It's like on the big screen, this projection of America. And what's remarkable, too, is the remarkable cooperation among different sectors of the United States to promote this image. So clearly it's business, advertising, but the American government was so active in supporting this promotion. And we find all kinds of civic groups also very active. I write about Rotary Clubs and how active they were in connecting with Europeans and other people around the world. Reflecting on this American standard of living, this comfortable world from which they came. So it's a, you know, kind of a unity, a synchronicity that goodness knows you couldn't have found in Europe, which was so riven by class and also by different nationalities and different ethnicities.
Well, we have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. And here in Urbana, where we are, line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
About living standards and how we compare them, as somebody who, like me, who was born in India but spent long time in Europe before coming to the United States, it's interesting to compare because the ideas about what a good living standard is ought to include things that are not immediately tangible as a material comfort, but for example, the issue of Social Security and health was tackled in Germany as early as in the 1870s, whereas the common person in the United States did not see any of that until the middle of the 20th century, if I am correctly informed. The impression that the United States standard of living was so much higher, I believe, is primarily due to the space that is available in the United States that resulted in an abundance of food and spacious housing, which is the primary difference between what we see here and what we see in Europe. And a lot of it just emanates from that basic fact. If we compare today's living standards in Europe, part of it is certainly inspired by the United States influence, but there is a reverse influence on the United States that resulted in introduction of certain securities like Social Security, which was not part of the U.S. way of living. And today, we still have 40-some million people without health insurance in this country, whereas nobody in Europe goes without health insurance. If you count that to the standard of living, one wonders which way the influence is really going.
I agree with you. I'd say 99.9%. That this notion, this American notion of standard of living, was market-driven, based on the individual's capacity to buy goods, and it would never refer to collective goods, to the social goods that make that individual's acquisitive power possible. So, all the studies that were done, which then became a kind of model, didn't count that pensions, or they didn't count how much was being done by government to back this high standard of living that the government was putting in roads, the cars, the government was putting in sewage pipes for all the flush toilets and so on and so forth. And above all, it never monetizes in the United States the cost of these important elements like Social Security, health insurance, and so on. So the Americans do get those, and those are added into the high standard in the 1930s. But I would agree with the argument, and do say this in the book. The Europeans, in the end, combine this access to a higher standard through their own jobs to this great cluster of what we call social or collective goods. And to me, the end of this American revolution in consumer culture is marked by the fact that our services have failed in many respects, and it's simply not enough to buy cheap goods, that the standard of living thereby has greatly dropped, especially with respect to the European standard, which combines and recognizes that you need not just individual buyers looking out for their families and themselves, but this array of social, collective, community goods.
You mentioned the role of education. Before World War II, many of our scientists were trained in Europe, and the standard of education there, especially at the high school level, seems to remain pretty high and contributes to the ultimate standard of living. And the influence, if it could be the reverse way from Europe, would be beneficial to us.
Certainly, I want to insist that Irresistible Empire is arguing about a very particular notion of the power of a consumer culture, a very particular notion of the standard of living that comes out of our resources in the United States, the way our people, government, private citizens, businesses have articulated a particular kind of standard. It's not the only one, but my interest is how it became hegemonic in the course of the century, and then in the end of the century, I would argue, from the last quarter of the century, how it begins to fracture and decline. So that, what you're saying is absolutely right, that, today, in the last, certainly the last two or three decades, one could very much argue about whether the United States expresses a superior standard of living anymore, and many people would criticize it on important grounds.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to another caller here, Champaign County, our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hi. I want to second all of those comments. Those are quite important, and I think they're quite corrective. You mentioned gunload diplomacy, and I would like to point out that while, Wilson was urging Americans, capitalists, to go out and sell, the U.S. was exerting gunload diplomacy and, enforcing the Monroe Doctrine, as it were, in the Caribbean and all over Latin America. And we were using the Navy as a collection agency for Brown Brothers Bank. So a lot of it was against European capitalism and getting into that area. So there's a whole, if you want to look in these broad scopes, you have to include that kind of thing. I wanted to make one quote from Thomas Friedman, who is sort of a cheerleader for this kind of soft power kind of thing, though he occasionally blurts something out. This is a pretty infamous quote, and it goes as follows. The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas. The hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies to flourish is called the U.S. Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps. And I think, despite my disagreeing with him most of the time, that he has said something that's irreducible, that you can't have the so-called soft power without the hard power, and I think when it comes down to it, the U.S.'s defining role in the world is more the military role, and I regret that. It's, I lament it, but I think that I'm very uncomfortable with your thesis and how it fits into the whole iconography of the U.S. Current milieu,
one of the characteristics is this of this market empire, which I characterize, is that it rests on a notion of peaceableness, which it itself is not pursuing. That is, don't usually agree with Tom Friedman, but I utterly understand that McDonald's is related to the other side of the equation. That is, it is force and coercion. And what I think we need to understand better is persuasion element and how it fits in with war. Because what made the country so unusual is that it presents always its peaceable side, and you know, in courses of war, its capacity to grow as a consumer power increases, while during war, that of Europe sinks. And when the war ends, its model appears all the more overweening, all the more powerful. So the two, that is, you know, war and this peaceable-looking power go hand in hand, utterly. And that's the story here of Irresistible Empire. You know, it's taking that dimension of Friedman's argument and playing it out for all it's worth over a century. And what we see now at the end of the century is that the persuasive side no longer works. And more the investment is in the military side. And more, every effort to sell the American model shows up that it's a bad product. And the sell now doesn't work anymore.
Well, it seems to me that I think it was a pretense, and I didn't really buy it, that it was working in the fashion that you were saying. I mean, to some extent, it's undeniable that Hollywood movies farm this, but I don't think it's the fundamental motive and momentum in this empire. The U.S. as a democracy can't be an empire, and it shouldn't want to be. And I have to go. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, whether it wants to be an empire or not. My argument says that it has been a particular kind of empire, a market empire, which is in many ways a much looser kind of empire than the closed empires of the earlier times, the British Empire, the French Empire, the Spanish Empire, and that we need to understand these two faces and how they interact, that is, the war side and the peace side, in order to understand when times shift. And when we move in one direction rather than the other.
I want to go back and talk about a couple of the other themes that you deal with in the book that have to do with how American manufacturers sold things to Europeans. And on the one hand, I'm interested in the marketing, not so much the where people went to buy things. I wanted to do that, but set that aside, more to the idea of the promotion of American products, because certainly in Europe they had European manufacturers of whatever it is. You know, they made phonographs, they made razors, they made automobiles, they made all of those things. How is it that American manufacturers went about persuading Europeans that something that was made in the United States or that had an American label on it was better than the equivalent product that was made in Europe?
Well, the European manufacturers operated very well locally and oftentimes with unbranded goods. So, using a local razor that you would get from a shop, the brand profile would be very high. And generally, European manufacture had to be on a smaller scale. The markets were smaller than in the United States. And the American corporations had the advantage of a very large scale, were operating on a very large scale and competing on a very hard market, the American domestic market. So they invested an enormous amount in creating a very powerful brand profile, which then allowed them monopolies over whole sectors of goods, especially new goods. One thinks of, let's say, Gillette coming in and saying, I'm the first self-shaving razor. And then having, acquired huge capital, lots of skill, all kinds of new technologies in the United States, capacities to market, they then move abroad where they are amidst, much smaller firms. And this gives them a huge advantage, and often even a monopoly, because they're offering a new product. And with enormous merchandising power behind them, but also then American government support frequently, they are able to generate a huge amount of promotional attention. And that succeeds in driving out the small ones, or they buy out the more successful ones. We can see that again and again in new sectors, you know, whether that's Coca-Cola or Gillette Razors or Procter & Gamble's various kind of detergents and other cleansers.
Hmm.
So there, it's size, American size, but it's also, you know, a capacity to say this good is culturally right for, it'll make you modern. And I think we always have to keep in mind that it's both a very big economic power. It's an economic power that's backed by the American state and all of its commercial attachés abroad. But it also acquires a kind of cultural dynamism to define, oh, this is a modern product, and, you know, try it.
Hmm. Another thing that you talk about has to do with the American style of retailing, which also was brought to Europe, and perhaps it was in some sense the kind of story that we have seen here in the United States, as smaller retailers or independents have been driven out of business by bigger ones. The same thing happened, and while here now we have heard about, for example, in recent times, organizations like Walmart and Kmart going into Europe in the 90s, that certainly is not a new story either, because going back to the 20s, Woolworth, for example, was in Europe and doing sort of the same kinds of things, changing the ways in which people shopped by changing where people shopped.
Exactly. I mean, the Walmart story sounds so familiar if you have seen, you know, how Woolworth operated in the 20s and 30s, and then you see how American supermarket capital burst into Europe very often with lots of, you know, political support for it, because it represented the possibility of slashing prices, which government authorities wanted. It represented the possibility of showing that the communists couldn't win, that capitalism had a better way to improve people's lives by cutting costs, offering them variety, entertaining them with advertising. So, you know, again and again, we see that, you know, American corporations, first of all, they practice in the United States. They build up a lot of momentum cutting around the United States, which is a really very difficult market with lots of different segments. And then, you know, practice makes perfect, and they go abroad. They have no reason not to. The American market gets saturated, and they're restless. They're born restless from moving around the United States. And the European market, especially since the 1950s, is a very rich market. It's the, you know, richest market after the United States, and it offers you know, a big space in which they can settle down and, you know, make a lot of profits.
Yet another little piece of this that I think is really interesting that you deal with in the book has to do with women, essentially, and their role as a purchasing agent, I guess, for the family in Europe, and how securing their participation was also very important for those people who were interested in selling the American standard of living, and very specifically in selling American goods. How were women specifically targeted and specifically marketed to by American salespeople?
Yeah, I mean, we can see it in even in American government, and, you know, famous Nixon-Khrushchev debates at the Moscow Fair in 1958, that, you know, there is the tendency for kind of this American ideology to say, we treat women right. You know, we have the necessities of life taken care of, and all women in the world should have those rights, the right to be real women in their households with all of this kitchen equipment. And this is, now it seems like a very old-fashioned vision. But you know, corporations picked up on that, and, you know, in moments where, you know, European societies were changing, it did allow a kind of access into the household, you know, this image of the, you know, the beautiful woman standing at her, you know, her laundry machine, contrasted with what was often a reality. That is, that doing the washing either required maids being hired at dirt cheap rates, or the woman of the house, you know, washing with a washboard, real drudgery. So it was playing on this contrast between the image of a modern woman, the kind that you saw in the movies, who never soiled her hands, and the reality that working women in Europe were slaves to household labor. And that was an important element of the class distinction in European society, that upper class women didn't do drudge work, and lower class women did do the drudge work. So that this kind of advertising goes in and says, you know, liberate yourselves, purchase this new kind of household equipment that will free you from the particular drudgery of housework. Now, that had been worked already through in the United States, but in Europe, because of the division between women, between the upper class type of women's lives and the lower class, it had an especially powerful impact. And then it's picked up very quickly by European appliance manufacturers too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Moulinex's advertisement is, Moulinex will free women, will liberate women. So it played on began to play on this kind of feminist notion of freedom through more and more appliances.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. I have another caller we will get right to, and I would like to introduce again our guest for anyone who has joined us here in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We're speaking with Victoria DeGrazia. She is an historian. She's on the faculty at Columbia University. She specializes in the contemporary history of Western Europe, and particularly the things that interest her are mass and consumer cultures, gender, the history of family politics. She's authored a number of books, and the most recent, if you're interested in this subject here we're talking about this morning, is Irresistible Empire, and it is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. We have another caller here, someone on our toll-free line, and we'll get right there. Hello. Is a caller there, line 4?
Oh, hello.
Yes.
I'm a little bit puzzled by the Walmart-Woolworth analogy, because Woolworth was an English company. And a friend of ours who travels to England regularly, this was some years ago when people were getting upset about Japanese ownership, he said that actually a lot of companies are owned by the English, and they were the first ones here.
Well, you know, when Germans came to the United States, they said, gosh, we thought Woolworth was a German company. But it was founded by Frank Woolworth in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in 1879. And it went into England in 1909, and very rapidly it outstripped Marks and Spencer. And it became so local that the Red Front, as they used to call it, began to be called an English store.
Oh, but it wasn't. That's interesting. So it started in Pennsylvania in 1879.
Yes, the big question will that happen with Walmart in another 30 years? If we see Walmart on a British street, will we say, that's British? And if so, what will that mean about the stretch of American market empire? What will it mean about the changes that have occurred in British retailing? So that's the kind of problem that I'm trying to address here, that these big companies will go out, they will settle in, they will change everything, and, you know, after several years, after this rupture, which they've gotten a lot of political force behind them, they will start to look more and more, shall we say, native, you know, changing the customs slightly in various ways. So, you know, we end up like an archaeology, like if we were in ancient Rome, we'd look, pick up a pot and say, and if we were in traveling in, let's say, in Gaul, and say, what does this say about the reach of the Roman Empire? You know, it looks like it's local, but we can see from the signs that it's not local. It comes from Rome.
Ah, that's interesting. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Kankakee for another caller here. Now this is line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Your caller always likes to extend the narrative in the present, and was wondering, is there any way that this strategy is able to be pursued successfully now, or are only strategies military?
That, it's an excellent question. And,
wonderful question.
And it was raised in a sense by an earlier caller too, you can again kind of take a pass at that, Professor DeGrazia. It sounds as if you were saying that the answer to the question is maybe the commercial power we have exhausted that, and for that reason perhaps the only thing the United States can now fall back on is military power.
Well, the United States is an incredibly inventive country, and we can, you know, be optimistic about that to the degree that, you know, it's going to have to turn its inventiveness now to renewing its technological edge. Okay, right now Walmart is very new with respect to Woolworth. Woolworth created national manufacturing. It stopped sourcing in Europe and started sourcing in the United States. Walmart has outsourced to China, and the question is now, has the U.S. lost its capacity to be on the edge? And if so, is it going to only, shall we say, rule, exercise its power by, you know, being the outsider, by being unilateral, or is it going to go back to, you know, arousing this great capacity to reinvent itself as a, you know, power with high standard of living that could come from a much better quality of life? But that means, you know, investing in ecological industries. It means, you know, thinking in a much more utopian way about what a good standard of living is. And that's going to mean more collective goods, you know, more social goods, more of the goods like the pensions, the high educational standards, the health insurance that other countries have been experimenting with. So I don't want to end on such a pessimistic note. Let's end on a utopian note that there are other ways still to go.
I think that probably if, as a recent guest, Richard Florida, spoke of the Creativity Index made up of talent, technology, and tolerance, if the right edge can be found, certainly we may continue with an irresistible empire. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have talked about the fact that, or at least alluded to the fact that substantially before now, the criticism has been made of America that we have come to the point where we define our well-being in terms of our material standard of living. And a lot of people would say that that's a mistake, that that's not valuing the things that really matter. And I'm sure that the same kind of thing is said and has been said for some time in Europe, that you can't simply value the material things and use that as an indicator of whether you're doing well or not. I guess I'm interested in as this kind of story that we're talking about goes back at least before World War II, whether indeed all the way along there have been people in Europe who have been making that critique and saying, wait a minute, it's not just about our stuff. There are more important things, and we've said here in Europe, we have believed that for a long time. Why are we moving away from that?
Oh, so much debate, so much complaint, so much worry that Europeans were succumbing to a materialist vision, and that was being promoted by the American. I think now the debate continues, and it even indeed is being renewed in Europe. The argument is that this level of material existence is being undermined by new kinds of class distinctions. It's being undermined by resource constraints. It's being undermined by the dangers to future generations coming from the terrible environmental issues that this kind of materialism, but also that Western materialism, and they, you know, critics are willing to put America and Europe together, distances the West from the rest, and that there are huge global problems, and that they can't be addressed while this Western standard of living is so absorbing of resources. So there are lots of you know, interesting movements, what they call critical consumption, or the slow food movement is another one, that are raising all kinds of questions about the standard of living based on, you know, high mass consumption, basically driven through the market. And that's a conversation that's not only European. There's a lot of possibilities of it moving transatlantic, and as we see also with lots of new global connections as well.
Yeah. Well, that's a good spot for us to end, and we must, because we're at the end of the time. The book, once again, if you'd like to read it, is titled Irresistible Empire. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, by our guest, Victoria DeGrazia. She is professor of history at Columbia University. And Professor DeGrazia, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Thank the callers as well.